about this topic that, do I need to make a formal announcement to this about what this is about?
We can be very informal. It looks like it's certainly a small group.
No, that's fine. I'm Jeff Simon, and our topic is the care and feeding of church musicians. And let's find out why you all are, why are you interested in this topic? You want to start?
Well, it's because, of course, I'm interested in the church, and this friend of mine wanted to go to another session, and she is in charge of something like this. And of course, I have an argument with my neighbor about this, and we don't end up enemies. But my feeling is this. Well, you know how I feel. I just express my thoughts, and I was shocked to find. Well, sure. We're very fortunate in our church. We have 3 organists. But that's beside the point. Why should they pay for their own music? And why shouldn't they be paid for their time? This is something special. They've put in a lot of time and study being an organist. Anybody else want to call?
The reason that I'm here, I'm a member of the choir at our church and a close friend of the organist and the choir director. And I was just kind of interested how other churches, the choir directors and musicians in other churches function.
Mm-hmm. What church are you from?
I'm from St. Patrick's Church in Tacoma.
I'm Nancy Isaacson. I'm from Tacoma also.
My name is Chris Jensen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot to. I'm Ken Frank. I always get into arguments with most everybody around the court here. But
well, there's nothing wrong with that either. That's no. That's what makes good discussion.
I'm from Spanaway Lutheran Church, and Spanaway is just okay. The next suburb south of Tacoma. Mm-hmm. And I am a church musician. I'm a choir director.
Okay. So you have a vested interest in that. Hi.
One other thing that I feel this, if I had my way about it, and the church could afford it, all choir members would be paid for this reason, that they put in a lot of time. My wife wouldn't agree with me, and she sings in the choir, and I know, but she just thoroughly enjoys it.
But there is a difference there.
Yeah,
the difference.
Well,
if they are not professional singers,
yes,
not trained specifically,
yes,
then your parallel would be more with, with some of the other service organizations, mm-hmm, in the parish, who are volunteering their time to do something that they believe is important and that they enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is when the position is defined as requiring a degree of competency, which means training and experience, for which the person has had to pay, and which makes the person a professional, for which compensation is appropriate. We were just going around the room asking, why are you here? What is it about this esoteric topic that interests you? Since you just came in, you're on the spot.
I'm on the spot. Mm-hmm. I'm just interested in music. I participated in the church choir before and played a little bit of organ. Mm-hmm. I'm just interested in the topic.
Okay. Well, okay, let's start with saying that no set of guidelines will be workable across the board in all parishes for the simple reason of size. A parish of 100 members cannot possibly budgetarily support the same kind of a program that a parish of 500 can, or of 1,000, or whatever. So, with that as sort of background, we can talk about the ideal situations where budget is not a problem, if one can ever reach a place where budget is not a problem, but at least where it is within the possibilities of the parish to employ at least one professional musician. I think the first place you have to start is to define the position. What do you expect of the resident musician? In terms of the person's capabilities, experience, and training, how many hours a week do you define the job as taking? And here you have to remember that it is not a rehearsal night and a Sunday morning job, because for every hour of actual service playing, the organist has to put in many hours of practice, which in all fairness have to be counted as part of the job, because you can't do the job properly without that practice. I think it helps to equate things like this with things that the clergy do. You certainly expect the pastor to spend time preparing sermons, and that is part of the job requirement, and part of the time requirement for that, and practice time for an organist or for a choir master is analogous to sermon preparation time. It means that the study of the literature and the preparation of it, registration, all that. Are we getting another?
Is this chalet number one?
Yes, it is. Join us. We've gone around the room and talked about why the people that are here are here. What is it that, what is your interest in the topic?
Okay, we have the immediate thing that triggered my interest is the fact that our church choir director organist is just leaving quite soon. We're going to be hiring a new one. And so just any kinds of input on what kinds of beneficial staff relationships or relationship between the church musicians and the congregational council committees might be helpful.
Okay.
Always a learner in that area.
Okay, I was just saying that the first thing that needs to be considered is what are the requirements of the position. And this is particularly important when you do go to make a change. It's like a position description within the world of business, with certain differences. I know of several parishes where councils have had, I don't know exactly what the word is, time study people who have worked with major corporations. And so they've instituted time studies on the church staffs in a multiple staff situation, where each person on the staff, including the musician, had to sit down at the end of each day and write down, you know, how much time did you spend on the phone talking to church members, how much time did you spend doing this, that, and the other thing. I always thought they should add at the bottom of the form, you know, 20 minutes spent in filling out this stupid form. There are certain bounds within the musical world where this just doesn't work, in that the situation changes from week to week in a way that it doesn't change from week to week in the average, you know, if you're talking about a stenographer in a business or an accountant, you can pretty much say that week to week, other than income tax time for the accountants and so on, things are going to pretty much stay the same. The musician may spend 5 or 10 hours more 1 week than another, preparing music for a given service, depending on whether it is a festival service or if there's, you know, just something out of the ordinary about it that required more time in searching out the literature and preparing it, and so on. So I think you have to realize that there will be great difficulty in coming up with a hard and fast, concretized system of saying how many hours per week. But you can come up with a ballpark figure. There is a pamphlet which is of, I think, great help in doing this. It's published by the American Guild of Organists, with headquarters in New York City. And the reason it's a great help is because it lists a lot of things that church musicians have to do that the average person in the parish never dreams about. It includes things like janitorial duties. You have to arrange the chairs in the choir room. Library duties. Somebody has to collect the music, the anthems and all that, and put them away. When new music comes in, it's got to be cataloged, stamped probably, and put away. It all has to be passed out. All of this kind of thing which people don't normally associate with a church musician, but it has to be done. Now, if you've got a big choir, then you can usually elect a librarian who will help with this and so on, and then that's fine. But it is still the responsibility of the musician to see that it is done. And this pamphlet also takes into account training, the degrees that the person holds, if any, and comes up with a formula where you can figure salary. Some people would be very shocked at the salaries that are recommended in that, because they equate pretty much with professional clergy salaries on a full-time basis. And what you do is start with the number of hours that the job is determined being, and then take that full-time figure and divide it by the number of hours. But I think it's a very helpful document because it does show the whole range of things that church musicians often end up doing that have not too much to do with actual music making. Once the job is defined, then you have to find the person to fill it. The volunteer church musician has been of great value to many parishes, but can also be a great problem, because if the person is a volunteer and is not performing at the level that you want, if the hymns are not being played properly to begin with, if the choir is not singing as well as they should, if the literature that's being selected is not appropriate to the liturgy, then what are you going to do? You can't come and say, you're not doing your job the way you were supposed to, because the person is volunteering to begin with, and so I think you're better off treating the position as a professional position, even if it is not filled with the kind of professional that you might ideally like to have. But treat it as such. Make it a salaried position, even if it's a small salary due to size of congregation and budget. Scripture does say the laborer is worthy of his hire, and I think it's certainly true that you'll end up with better music, as the person will feel that he or she is appreciated. And if the incumbent really feels wrong about being paid because he or she really has another job and does not consider yourself to be professional, then that person can always turn the salary back over to the church in the form of a contribution, which is then tax deductible, and everybody's happy. When you have a professional musician, you know, what can you require of the musician, and what can the musician expect from the parish? You need, in the position description, to indicate the level of competency that you expect. Now, what kind of training? Do you want the person to have a bachelor's degree in music, master's degree, doctorate? At what level do you want your music program to be functioning? And with that done, then you can more easily examine the qualifications of people who are applying for the position and compare them with your requirements. One thing that many churches don't do is to check references, and you should. Now find out, where has this person served previously? And then call up that place, or the couple, particularly if there's a record of rapid changes in, you know, somebody's gone from one church to another and there's actually three positions in the past 3 years. There may well be a problem there that that you won't find out about unless you do some checking. As far as who should do that checking, the chairman of the search committee should certainly nominally have that responsibility. Sometimes the pastor may have to do it if there is material of a confidential nature involved that the previous church might not want to release to someone that they didn't know or have confidence would respect the trust involved. But you can often get a good feel for the kind of work that a person did by checking references. And then, of course, understanding that often personality conflicts have been the cause of musicians leaving employ. If you hear sort of sotto voce this problem in a contact, approach it openly with the candidate. Say, I hear that you and Pastor so-and-so just couldn't get along at your previous church. We'd like to hear what you have to say about that. And give the person an opportunity to respond to that. The church musician should be treated like the other people on the staff, whether there's one or five or six, in terms of, first of all, having a contract. Many, many church musicians work without contracts, and it's really not fair to them to be in a position where they can be terminated for no reason and no notice. Now, it doesn't happen very often, but it does happen.
Do you have any samples of contracts? We do have contracts in our church. I'm not sure how well they're written.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know really what a contract should say. It doesn't say anything about termination of the contract.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the first things it should say.
And it doesn't say that. It's more flowery as far as serving the church and being concrete.
Yeah, a contract is not a place to engage in philosophy. A contract is simply hard and fast terms of employment. again specifying we expect you to perform the following services, and we will provide this kind of compensation and fringe benefits, if any. If we are not happy with the services, we will do the following, and so on. If you want to leave, you should give us so much notice. That's there are some sample contracts in this same pamphlet that I mentioned, which is called the compensation of the church musician.
I've seen the book.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't have any with me, but that's, in essence, that's what they provide for. And they have often clauses like the organist shall be allowed the use of the church organ for teaching purposes, which, by the way, pays benefits to the church, because organs are better when they are used. Now, the worst possible thing for an organ, by which I mean one with pipes, is to sit for days without being used, because the leathers in it then do not get exercised enough. They dry faster, they wear out faster, and so, you know, the worst thing for a church is a locked organ console. They need to be used. And also, if they're not used for students, you know, where is the next generation of organists for the church going to come from? You know, if the church says, no, you can't use our instrument, or if the organist says that, then you're cutting off your own future.
Can the musicians' union be a factor in any of the things that you've been talking about?
No, there is no union. There's been a great debate for the last, the last decade within the American Guild of Organists, which is not a union. It is a guild, about whether or not the guild should become more like a union. There are strong feelings on each side, but what they have chosen to do is to operate as a support system and as in an advocacy position, rather than to try to go the union route. Most church musicians are not members of the musicians union, unless they happen to be in a large metropolitan area if they're a keyboard person, you know, because most symphony orchestras only carry one or at the most two keyboard people.
Mm-hmm.
Which would require union membership, or if they happen to play something else or are involved in professional music outside of the church. Even if they are, their union standing would not be affected by what they do within the church.
One question. We'll suppose the organist is giving a lot of lessons. Could this organ be overused?
No.
Should they be expected to compensate the church for
the organ will not be damaged by overuse. The only expense which the church incurs would be the electricity for mm-hmm. the blower motor
and heat.
And if the church is heated in the wintertime, what you generally do there these days is you have one of those large quartz heaters next to the console,
mm-hmm.
so that you don't have to heat the whole church, and on the other hand, your fingers don't get so cold that you can't play 3 days in a row.
Just an electric heater sitting right there.
Mm-hmm. One that has either is large enough or has a fan in it so that the heat does get to where you need it.
Oh, okay, that's all it takes.
And likewise summertime, if there is no cooling and it's in a hot climate, you need a fan in the absence of air conditioning.
Yeah.
I'll have some more to say in the organ session about organs per se and how they respond to temperature and humidity changes. But the basic answer to your question is no, you can't. You can't overuse it. And that's less true with electronics, because the electronic components do wear out from use, where the pipe organ components tend to be better with use.
Ours is a pipe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In terms of staff relationships, the ideal situation is that the musician is actively involved in the entire worship planning that goes on within the congregation, which may mean a simple one-to-one meeting every week with the pastor, or it may mean staff in a larger church, or it may mean meeting with a committee, if you have a committee that's actively involved in liturgical planning. But as music is an integral part of what goes on in worship, it certainly is obvious that you can't have the musician functioning out here in left field and expect to have any kind of sense being made or interaction between the music and the word. This would be in the contract, by the way, that, you know, how many meetings, how many groups do you have to meet with? How many of those are during normal working hours? How many evening meetings are going to be required? Because particularly if the person has a family, you need to be able to plan accordingly that you're going to be out two nights a week or one night a week or, you know, whatever. But this planning needs to go on several levels. There is the week-to-week planning, but there is also the long-range planning. This is somewhat easier for the musician within a tradition like the Lutheran or the Anglican or the Roman Catholic tradition, where you know in advance what the texts are going to be for a given Sunday. It is much more difficult where the pastor does not follow a set of pericopes, but follows the free church tradition of preaching on whatever he or she wants to preach about. When the musician knows ahead of time what the central theme of the worship is going to be, then the planning can go on 6 months ahead of time. I always do mine at least that far ahead in terms of choosing anthems, because the choir has to have several months to learn the music. And if you don't know until, you know, the day before what the hymns are going to be, for instance, as an organist, you can't possibly coordinate your organ preludes to go with the hymns. If you don't know what's going to be preached about, you can't coordinate your anthems with what's going to be preached about. So there has to be close coordination between minister and musician to make the music make sense as an adjunct to the word, which is what it should be. In terms of selecting hymns, again, I think the best way is for that to be done together. The worst way is for the minister to hand the organist a list of hymns 2 days before or 3 days before and say, here they are. And that happens here quite a bit. There are times when I don't find out what the hymns are for Vespers until 15 minutes beforehand, in which case I may as well be replaced by a jukebox. You know, put a quarter in, and out comes the hymn. that means that you have no time to prepare with any kind of integrity what you're going to do. You don't often even have time to read the text of the hymn, which is the first thing you have to do before you're going to start playing the notes. You have to read what is the message of this hymn, let alone do work out anything about introducing the hymn or playing varied accompaniments to it. So that kind of planning has to happen as far in advance as possible.
That's a question about that. The organist and I have struggled for quite a period of time with our pastors on this issue. And one of our pastors does not want to pick the hymn of the day until he has written his, so basically, until he has really gone to the text study on the text for the Sunday, which occurred 4 days in advance of Sunday, and really worked on a sermon. And I can kind of see his point there, that it really does follow things up musically for us. And we've worked on trying to have planning meetings and studying the text in advance, and that is his key argument against actually making a decision, is that he is not, does not feel that he's prepared the text adequately enough to work on a sermon, and therefore, cannot get into the hymn.
Well, there are two possibilities there. One is to pick the other two hymns.
That's what we do.
In advance, and not worry about that one. The other is to try to encourage him to get a week ahead of himself in text study. At least, even if he doesn't actually have the sermon written, if he could do the text study a week ahead, actually he'd probably be more comfortable with it than by the time he gets to getting the sermon
it's
down.
It's hard to break a 4-year-old habit.
Oh yes, it may be impossible. The other thing would be to consider what, the hymnal selections in the back of the hymnal, which suggest a hymn of the day. See if he would be willing to accept those. That may just be one of those problems there is no solution to, other than what you've already done, which is to do the other two. But at least you're two-thirds of the way there, which is a lot farther than some folks are. In the absence of the pamphlet that I mentioned, what many places take as a benchmark for salary for church musicians is, again, talking about a full-time job, is what are the teachers in the local district paid? Now, that's not going to be a high salary, because teachers aren't well paid either, but at least it's something. Because teachers are required to have degree and certification. So with that same kind of background, with a basic AB degree in music, or could be a Bachelor of Music or a Bachelor of Science in Music, with any of the basic baccalaureate degrees, that can give you a benchmark in determining what would be a fair compensation. These days, it shouldn't make any difference whether the person is has a spouse who is also working. Now, sometimes that is used by churches as an excuse for paying lower salaries. If they hire a woman as an organist, well, her husband makes $40,000 a year, she doesn't need to be paid as much as this person over here whose husband is making less or whatever. The job should be considered apart from, and compensation for it should be considered apart from the individual circumstances of the person who is being hired for the job. Whatever pension benefits are available to the other full-time staff, should be available to the church musician, or an alternate form of the same. If for instance, the minister is in a plan that does not allow non-ordained people to participate, then an alternate type of pension plan should be made available, as well as medical care and so on. Now, for part-time positions, these things all change, obviously. But we're talking about, you know, ideal situations, so have to go from there. For smaller parishes, it becomes more important to help the musician continue in training. And some of this can be sort of an alternate form of compensation, where because of size and budget, it's not possible to pay a particularly good salary. There are workshops in almost every part of the country every year, normally in the summer, but often some of them will take place in January, in the sort of, you know, dead parts of the year when people have more time to go to them. Workshops in all facets of church music. Some are in literature to acquaint you with what's being published currently. Some are in service playing, improvisation, choral techniques, vocal techniques, and it's certainly, again, to the church's benefit to provide opportunity for the musician to attend at least one of these workshops annually. Some churches also subsidize their musicians going to the either regional or national convention of the Organist Guild, because that, again, is a... Organist Guild conventions are funny things, because it's the only organization of musicians where musicians go to hear other musicians performing on the same instrument. You know, you don't have violinists all going to one place to hear other violinists play, but organists do this every year, and so it's a way to hear new music, hear other people play. Which brings me to another one of my favorite ideas, which nobody has adopted, but I really think, again, the church would be better off if it required of its clergy and its musicians that they take sabbaticals. Now, it may not be a whole year, maybe 6 months. If it's 6 months, I would say for the first 3 months, don't even go to church. Do your praying at home, read your scripture at home, and so on. But you need to get away from it for a while. Take the other half of the time and go to a different church every Sunday morning, hear other people preach, hear other people play services, and recharge your batteries that way. I think, again, that the time off, it would be well spent, and the church would end up being the richer for it. We all get stagnant. After X number of years in the same job, I hardly ever get to hear somebody else play a service. Now, my vacation this year is out here, so, you know, so I'm still doing it while I'm not at my regular place on Sunday morning, but I'm still playing services, and I'm not hearing other people do it. And I need to.
What would our pastor say if you criticized him, I wonder, about his sermon?
Who knows?
But I agree with you. I think this is an excellent idea.
Well,
that they should take time off. And
I think sometimes you're just too scared to say things. I think the pastor would really like to hear, mm-hmm. you know, both the good and the bad. Mm.
Yeah, I think, again, where it's a younger pastors are more likely to be open to suggestions about, you know, let's have a feedback session, say maybe once a month, where, you know, after the service, sit down over coffee and talk about it. And musicians need the same thing, in a constructive way. And we really liked this particular, but this stanza had us all confused. We didn't know what you were doing with that, and figure out why, in terms of him playing, why it didn't work. In the case of a sermon, you know, you're out of my area, but I've preached maybe six times in my life.
Applies one way as well as the other.
I have a question regarding regard to our organist who's been with us. She has been in charge of lining up some kind of special music, quote unquote, every Sunday during the summertime when the choir doesn't sing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just came to this church a couple of years ago and discovered that here, you know, maybe this is just my own ignorance, my own background, but they're accustomed to always hiring somebody to come in and sing every Sunday, rather than simply inviting the people in the congregation who like to sing and can do okay, provide that special music on a volunteer basis in the summertime. Do you have any thoughts about that? Assuming that the quality is not sacrificed.
Yeah, that's the real question, because the problem there usually is in who is going to tell the well-meaning person that their quality is not what you're looking for. Because once they volunteer, you're really in a pinch, you know. Because there are a lot of folks that think that they sing very well, and they do as long as they're the only person that's listening. But the alternate is, you know, you don't have to have. Why do you have to have special vocal music every Sunday?
Yeah, I agree with that too.
I think you're better off not having it for a while, because then when it's back, it's appreciated more.
Yeah, amen. I agree with that. I think that they're hung up on the idea that they have to have somebody every Sunday in the summertime.
Somewhat related to that question is, do you have any suggestions for recruitment of choir members? Our choir, where I'm from, suffers from a lack of members.
I don't have any magic solutions to that. The best kind of recruitment always comes from within the group itself. If members of the choir are enjoying what they're doing, they're the best salesmen you have. I think it certainly helps to have it supported in whatever church publications go out, and if you have announcements from the pulpit, then, you know, encouragement from the pulpit never hurts either. But once you get it going, the ongoing recruitment comes best from the choir members themselves. But they have to realize that it is part of their job, and they don't have the opportunity to sit out in the congregation very often and find out, you know, where are the good voices out here that could be in the choir. So occasionally during the year, you know, at least one Sunday during the year, give the choir a Sunday off, like the Sunday after Easter. Let the choir sit amongst the congregation and do a little scouting.
That's a good idea.
The Sunday after Christmas is another time where you can have a sort of a family kind of service with a lot of carols. You don't need to have more special music. You probably have a lot of it on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, if you have Christmas Day services. So that Sunday after can be without the choir. And it also does give the choir a chance to sit with their members of their family, other than in the summertime, which is nice.
How do you get rid of a person that's very past their prime? Do you say, well, the organist doesn't like your singing? So, I know this is really a touchy
It's that's the hardest thing in the world to do. I was asked that question once in a job interview, and I somewhat tongue in cheek said, "Well, I would refer the problem to the pastor." But no, I think when a person comes to that point where he or she is really a detriment to the choir, you just have to bite the bullet. You have to sit down with the person, and if you think it's going to be a really touchy situation, then ask, if you have choir officers, ask the choir president to sit in, and the pastor. And in other words, if this is a pillar of the church who's been singing for 40 years, mm-hmm. or 50, and who simply cannot hit the notes anymore, and now sometimes people realize that they, you know, it's part of their life. It always has been. They love doing it, and they realize that their voices are not doing what they used to, and so they back off volume-wise, and you hardly ever hear them. But when you've got one that's, you know, the bull in the china shop, there really is, you for the sake of the choir and for the sake of the congregation, you've got to simply sit down with them and say, you know, we appreciate all that you have meant to this choir, and we hope you'll continue to be part of the fellowship of this group in your, you know, in your social life. But the time has come, just due to the ravages of the years on your voice, when you really have to retire from active participation in the choir. I think if you set up an ongoing program of choir recognition, you know, and give people some public appreciation for X number of years in the choir, then it becomes a little bit easier to make this annual recognition also a recognition of retirement from the choir. So what I'm saying is, if you don't have this problem right now, start your choir recognition program so that by the time it happens, you'll be better prepared to deal with it. But you really do, the hardest thing I've had to do in the past couple of years was to do that with a soloist. I have a quartet of section leaders who are professional singers and who are paid. The one had been there for 28 years, a tenor, and he simply was over the hill. He's 70 now, and he lasted a lot longer than a lot of good singers, but he had gotten to the point where the high range simply was gone. And I knew that politically it was going to be a big problem, because he has, you know, many friends in the congregation, but it was just one of those things. And there, we also had a committee meet of people from a sort of a cross-section of the congregation to advise myself and the senior pastor about, you know, how we should deal with this. We figured, the pastor and I pretty much knew what the answer was, but politically speaking, this gave it, you know, the backing of a significant group within the congregation. Mm-hmm. And then the two of us met with him and said, in essence, what I've said now is that you would do with a volunteer. We said, you know, that the time has simply come when you need to retire. He did not accept it gracefully, but...
He was being paid too, though, you said.
Yes.
Yeah.
That makes it, really does make it any easier.
I suppose, yeah.
And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't making his living at it.
No,
it was.
A lot of churches, especially large churches, I suppose, have a quartet of soloists and singers, mm-hmm. lead section leaders that are.
Yeah, that's them. And in some ways that's a carryover from the 19th century tradition when there was no choir, there was only a paid quartet. The paid quartet choir was a great feature in American churches for years and years. And there are some churches that have entirely paid choirs, but they're very few and far between. They're mostly the ones who have endowed, you know, large endowment funds that were provided for that purpose, for ongoing music. I can think of, you know, Washington is a fair-sized city, and I can only think of five professional, all paid choirs in the city. and three of those are at cathedral churches. Two of them are parish, Episcopal parish churches. What other areas would, have I not touched on? There's so many inns and small byways that if there's anything that I can answer in the next couple of minutes before Vespers.
Well, my feeling has been, of course, a lot of this, you touched on the problems that you have in the larger churches, but we are a small church, and a very small church, and we just build a new church and so on and so forth, but I don't think we have the money to pay what an organist should be paid. But my feeling had been this, that
do you have separate organist and choir director?
We have a choir person. Director, yes, and three organists. They switch off the organists.
But the first thing, first place you can make a change in terms of being able to pay a more decent salary is to have a single one person be both choir director and organist. Then instead of paying two people totally, low salaries, you can pay one person a medium low salary, perhaps.
As it is now, they get nothing. And I think they
that's more than medium low.
And they feel this, that they're doing their duty, and the church is having a tough time meeting their budget and so forth.
Well, but I think they should be paid. If they want to do that, pay them, and that's up to them.
Yeah, and to me, it would be a form of recognition, isn't that right? Didn't Christ give some praise or something to people? Is this wrong in the church? It seems to me a lot of people feel that way, that it's wrong to give recognition or praise to people.
Yeah. They're doing a job that is an important one, and they should be compensated for it. If they choose to return that compensation, then that's fine too.
Yeah. That's a privilege, and at least it gives them a professional status, which they should have. And if they want to get
it also helps put food on their table.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.